The views and opinions expressed in Cold and Missing are exclusively those of the hosts. All parties mentioned are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Cold and Missing also contains adult themes and languages. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm your host, Allie McLaughlin-Sulkowski.
And I'm your co-host, Eli Sulkowski.
And this is Cold and Missing, where we cover cold cases
and missing person cases.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Cold and Missing. I'm Allie.
And I'm Eli. Welcome back, everyone. We are on episode 97 this week.
Yes, this is episode 97. I hope everyone's having a great summer. We're cruising right into August, so I think we should just go ahead and get into this case.
Could you remind myself and the listeners, is this a cold case or missing person case this week?
We're on a cold case this week.
All right, well, let's get into it.
Today, we are talking about the cold case of Connie Heiner. And this takes place in January of 1996 in Reston, Virginia, which is just outside of Washington, D.C. But first, a little bit about Connie. Connie's full name was Constance, but she went by Connie, and that's how everyone knew her. And she had recently just celebrated her 48th birthday a few weeks prior to the new year of 1996. Connie had built herself from the ground up. She had had several failed marriages by the time that she met her current husband, Bob Heiner. When Connie was in her early 20s, she found herself with a baby girl, her only daughter, Brittany, and needing to start her life over. With only a high school diploma, she got a job working as a secretary and would occasionally bartend on the evenings for extra cash. She put herself through real estate school and got her real estate license. From there, she went on to college and got an accounting degree and eventually a master's in business. She married again and got a job working for low-income housing and was eventually a vice president of the company. It's here that she met Bob Heiner. The two were discreet, but eventually Connie left her marriage to marry Bob. Folks at work were shocked when the two turned up married because they had hid their feelings so well. Connie, around this time, also finds herself involved in Landmark. Landmark is a self-help program that some folks claim really works and transformed their lives. Others have called Landmark at best a pyramid scheme and at worst a cult. There is a French documentary about Landmark called Voyage au Pays au Nouveau Guerreau, which, pardon my French if that is incorrect, but it translates roughly to The Journey to the Land of the New Gurus. The documentary is from 2004, and Landmark attempted to get it scrubbed off of the internet, but eventually they dropped the case and it can still be found if you look for it. For Connie, Landmark had really worked. She took most of 1995 off on a sabbatical so she could focus on her training courses and bettering herself. As the new year approached, Connie landed her dream job. She was hired as the vice president of finance for a real estate trust in Columbus, Ohio. The job would require her to fly to Ohio every week. She had rented a two-bedroom apartment there, but on weekends she would come home to be with Bob. The commute was a lot, but this was her dream job. She was going to get the chance to run a company and would be on her way to becoming a millionaire. And now a timeline of events. On Sunday, January 1st, 1996, Connie and Bob attend a New Year's dinner party. According to friends, the couple were happy and content with each other. Connie was her usual bright and bubbly self. She was excited and telling their friends about her new job. She said that she had about a month of clothes currently packed. Her dream was to be able to fly without suitcases in the future. She was just planning on having everything she needed at the apartment. Her friends joked with Bob, quote, "Well, she's coming back, isn't she?" end quote. To which Bob responded, quote, "Oh yes, of course," end quote. On Monday, January 2nd, 1996, Bob gets up to get ready for work. As Bob gets ready to leave, Connie is still asleep, despite her needing to leave for the airport in an hour. According to Bob, she wanted just a few more minutes of sleep. Neighbors saw Bob leave around 7:10 that morning. He got into his Mercedes-Benz and drove off. He had a work meeting that morning. The person that he met with said that she didn't notice anything off or different about him. Connie had ordered a taxi to take her to the airport that morning. The taxi driver arrived just a few minutes after 8. He idled for a minute outside, and when no one came out, he went up to the door to knock. When he didn't get a response, he knocks again. Still no answer. The taxi driver makes one last attempt by trying to call the house number from his car phone. No one picks up. Slightly annoyed, the taxi driver heads off, assuming that she had arranged another ride and forgot to cancel. Around noon that day, Bob returns home from lunch. He walks into a massacre. He finds Connie, face down, on their bedroom floor next to the bed. She was in a pool of her own blood and nude. Bob immediately calls the police, who swarm the upscale neighborhood. Neighbors are shocked, as nothing like this had ever happened there before. Police begin to process the scene. There were no signs of forced entry, and nothing of value appeared to be missing. Her purse was still there, her car was parked in the garage, and her suitcase still packed. Police are able to tell immediately that this was a violent crime. Later, they'll refer to it as a crime of passion. Police are able to tell that she was bludgeoned with something and stabbed. Police do say that they're able to locate what they believe is the murder weapon. Investigators will never officially say what it is that they took from the home. Police believe that she was attacked while she was asleep. As police collect evidence from around the house, they collect a lot. They collect ashes from the fireplace, computers, date books. There's a lot taken from the home. One thing that they do notice is that despite the heavy rain that day, police didn't find any evidence that someone had tracked something in. No wet leaves, no mud, no shoe prints. While police are gathering evidence at the Heiner home, investigators have taken Bob to the station for an interview. According to police, he was very calm and businesslike. He was unable to provide any leads to police. When they asked him, "Why would someone want to kill your wife?" reports say that he responded with, quote, "It's a Washington thing, just crime in general," end quote. When asked outright if he had anything to do with the death of his wife, Bob said no. The next day, Tuesday, January 3rd, Connie's autopsy is conducted. It confirms that she was stabbed and bludgeoned with something. Most of the trauma was to her upper body. Despite being found in the nude, she had not been sexually assaulted. Police tell the media that they do have a strong lead, but again, decline to go into detail about what that strong lead is. Detective Dick Klein says, quote, "This was a crime of passion. It was not your random burglary or execution or robbery. This appeared to be personal. Whoever did this was very, very angry. No doubt about that," end quote. I personally believe that one of the strong leads that police were pursuing at this time is one of Connie's ex-husbands. He'll later tell the Washington Post, quote, "I was being looked at as a candidate for suspecthood. I was a good suspect. The ex-husband. I lived alone. I had no alibi. I was alone in my truck driving to work that morning. No one would remember seeing me," end quote. 4 days after Connie's murder, on January 5th, Connie's wake is held. This is where Connie's mother and sisters find out that she had been cremated, and they're upset. Connie had grown up as a strong Catholic, and they do not believe that Connie would have wanted that. However, in more recent years, Connie had drifted away from the Catholic faith, and she was more into New Age religion in the last years of her life. She would regularly connect with psychics as well for guidance. Brittany, Connie's daughter, will later tell the media that her mother did want to be cremated. Connie's mother and sisters become suspicious of Bob, but Brittany insists that Bob could not have done it. It is noted that around 25 people from the Landmark organization come to the funeral to pay their respects. Some of the family are suspicious of them as well. The next day, January 6th, Connie's funeral was supposed to be held, but a snowstorm forces Bob to cancel it. It's never rescheduled. Years later, Brittany will say, quote, "Bob and I asked the crematorium to dispose of the ashes. Then we lied and told everyone I was going to keep them. Bob had the right to make that decision. We didn't want to carry them around. I didn't want to be 60 years old and carrying them around. I didn't want them buried. I didn't want a stone. I didn't want to go to Kentucky to visit a grave. I didn't want to have to take my kids there to visit a stone," end quote. Eventually, Connie's mother will convince Brittany to send her the ashes, and she does bury them in Kentucky. In August of 1996, so it's been about 8 months since the murder of Connie, police make a plea to the public for any information in the murder. Police say that Connie had no enemies and she was well-liked by everyone in her life. But investigators say they also haven't been able to rule anyone out as a suspect. $1,000 reward is offered for information. Connie's case will fall out of the media until 1998. At this point, it's been 2.5 years since her murder. Police say that Bob is still a person of interest. He has never been named a suspect officially in the case. According to police, he hasn't done anything to help clear himself. Detective Dick Klein says, quote, "When a survivor doesn't call you ever to ask what I can do to help, that is out of the norm. That is a big red flag," end quote. However, Bob and his lawyer refute this. They point out that Bob handed over everything to the police that they asked for and let them search the home without a court order. Brittany remains close to Bob and has cut people out of her life that question him, including her grandmother and aunts. She does reveal that shortly after the murder, when her and Bob were still living in the home, one morning Bob was looking for a knife that they used to cut bagels with. He couldn't find it, and when they both searched for it, neither one of them could find it. They think that this was the murder weapon that police took with them. She also says that police recovered a hammer as well. Brittany, at this point, is trying to move on with her life. She's a mother now, and her focus is on her child. She tells the Washington Post, quote, "I often talk to Bob about not caring to know what happened, because to me, it was not about what happened. It was about her being gone. The desire to put the pieces together, to find out, was never important to me. It was not going to bring me closure to know who did it. If they caught him, I couldn't sit through a trial and hear described what happened. It would be too incredibly painful. I'd have a face. How scary would that be? They'd have a face. For me, it's much easier this way. I don't have to be afraid to turn around and see that face," end quote. And after this, the case truly falls out of the media. There doesn't seem to be any updates until the next time that her case is mentioned is 2020, when Fairfax police launch a new cold case website, and Connie's case is one of the first ones they feature. Connie's case is the only unsolved murder from 1996 for Fairfax County. So with that, if you know anything about the murder of Connie Heiner in January of 1996, please call the Fairfax County Police at 703-246-7511. So that is the case of Connie Heiner.
I found myself writing down multiple times, "I somewhat understand Connie's daughter's reaction, having now lost my mother myself. Granted, it was in a very different way. I just really understood where she was coming from in terms of the ashes and just the after parts of what happens after you lose someone. And again, the tragic ending to her mother's death was very different from my own mother's, but there, I think probably when you go through this, and maybe some of our listeners feel the same or agree in some way. Yeah, I was glad that she said something and felt firm in it and was like even vocalized afterwards about she didn't want to put a face to this person, you know, in full belief that it was not Connie's husband. Yeah, I don't know. It's really sad. It was difficult to listen to because you could just really sense that the trajectory of all of the lives affected by this, that they were changed forever. And that's always really heartbreaking because it's at the core of cases like these is the heartbreak of the people who are left behind.
Absolutely. And I just wanted to take a moment to kind of address why I chose to cover this case, since, you know, that quote I kind of read at the end, and you even referenced it, of Brittany not wanting to know, like, it wouldn't help bring her closure. I really wrestled with if I should cover this case, since that's kind of Brittany's thought. And I always try to keep the family at the front of everything I do and always trying to be respectful to the family. And with Connie's case, I feel that Brittany clearly has very strong boundaries, personal boundaries in her life. And I imagine she still has those today. But there are still people in Connie's life, like her mother and sisters, who do want to know what happened to her. And ultimately, somebody should have to answer for what happened to Connie. They shouldn't just be able to get away with it. So that is why I ultimately chose to cover Connie's case, because I really couldn't find that many like podcasts or recent media about her. So I wanted to get her name out there again.
Totally. And I know you, obviously, and know that you treat every case with the utmost respect and, honestly, tenderness, always, of how you approach it, how you investigate. So I know that about you, but just a second voice to echo what Allie said. There's always a delicate line to walk when we choose to engage with any case. And I also know that you weren't saying anything in a disparaging way towards her daughter not wanting to put a face to the person who committed this crime, to the person who ended her mother's life. It's heartbreakingly complicated. But yes, at the end of the day, a crime was committed. That person should be held responsible, and the people who want answers deserve to have them.
Exactly.
My question for you is to kind of circle back right to the beginning, to January 2nd. How tight is that timeline from when Bob leaves for work until he comes home for lunch?
So neighbors saw Bob leave around 7:10 a.m. that morning. And we know he gets to work. He has work meetings that morning. People see him. The taxi arrives just a few minutes after 8, and Connie doesn't come out. There's no answer. He doesn't see any movement in the house. And then Bob returns home for lunch right around noon.
Okay, so that's about 5 hours. My initial thought with that timeline was, it does give time to, at least to me, it does give time to make it look like no one ever came in or came out. If you localize the crime to one room, had the ability as someone who's committing this type of crime, like a breaking and entering, if you have the ability to make it look like nothing was broken to get in, you know, take your shoes off. I guess what I'm trying to say is, I thought it was plausible that it would still be someone who did not live in the home, I guess is what I want to say, to take the eyes off of her husband. And I guess I wanted to know what your thoughts were.
Yeah, the timeline is very critical here. Police have mentioned that they think the crime took place after Bob left and before the taxi driver arrived. So that would make the timeline around 50 minutes. I don't know exactly what supports them in that, like if they have the evidence, if it's coming from the medical examiner, as far as like a time of death, if they were able to kind of put that within a few hours, or if it's just as simple as since she didn't get in the taxi, they assumed she was already dead by that point. For me, it is a very complicated case. According to, you know, Bob and his lawyer, they have been very forthcoming with information. Anything that was asked, Bob turned it over. He turned over the house. He didn't ask for warrants or anything and immediately went down to the police station to answer questions. Police appear to have been suspicious of him from the beginning. Again, police always have to look at the spouse and kind of rule them out first. And it doesn't seem like they've ever really been able to rule Bob out. So that's complicated for sure. I will say, as far as like, could a stranger have committed this crime? According to investigators, they do believe that this was like a crime of passion and that this was personal. That's some language that they used right at the beginning of the investigation. But Bob's lawyer also pointed out that there was, you know, construction crews down the street that were already working that morning when Bob had left. And there was a utility worker next door who was also around throughout the morning, who didn't hear anything or see anything. So, you know, there is a lot of like opportunity for just a random act of violence to have happened. But with all that being said, I think that just it all boils down to like, we don't know. Like, we don't really know who did this. We don't know what the motivation was. Nothing was stolen. There was no sexual assault. It just was a murder. I would be curious to know, like, what the police know and what came out through interviews, and if, you know, there was anybody, if they did interview the construction workers and the utility worker, what did they see? What did they hear? I would be curious to know all that to see if it points anywhere.
Yeah, I think first and foremost, just you bringing it to our podcast and getting her name back out there again. This didn't happen that long ago. And as we know, with cases that, especially cases that have happened within the last 30 years, there is the possibility that if someone knows something, they are still alive. And I think that that's completely possible in this case as well, given the dates that this crime fall within. So I think really, you know, just you doing the investigative work of an unknown case and bringing it here will hopefully shake some information out. And I don't mean directly, I just mean with more people listening, hopefully more people talking about it, people talking about it on Reddit, maybe more podcasts cover Connie's case. And, you know, that's always the goal here.
Yeah, because ultimately, this was just a very horrific crime. And whoever did this doesn't need to be out amongst other people until there's been a chance for rehabilitation and some correction there. Because if this crime lacked any motive, it was just a random act of violence, like that's scary. And that person needs to answer for what they did to Connie. They don't just get to live their life without having to admit to what they did.
I think that the true, like, best case scenario here is a true balance of both peace and justice. Like, what the justice system is supposed to do in cases like this is to bring peace to the people who so desperately deserve it, and justice due where justice is due, you know?
Absolutely. So again, if you know anything about the murder of Connie Heiner in January of 1996, please call the Fairfax County Police at 703-246-7511.
While you are listening to this episode, as you reach the end, please, 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 if you haven't yet already, leave us a review, especially if you are in Apple Podcasts. And a rating right along with that at 5 stars would be great as well. We love reading the reviews every week. Oftentimes, I will be brushing my teeth or shaving or usually doing something in the bathroom, and Allie will run in and tell me something lovely that one of you has written for us in your review, which we always appreciate. We also have our Instagram, which I make all the graphics for. You can find us on Instagram at Cold and Missing.
We'll have photos of Connie up there this week. And we also post other active missing person cases or other podcasts that are covering cold cases or missing people. So if you're not following us, please check us out. It's a great resource for what's happening in the true crime community as well as what's happening in the podcast. And if you or someone you love is hard of hearing, we have transcripts on our website, www.coldandmissing.com. I do know Apple just came out with their new transcript feature. I don't have any control over that right now. It's just like a AI-generated thing, so it's not always correct. Sometimes it doesn't spell the names correctly, or it doesn't quite pick up what I'm saying correctly. So if you want the corrected transcripts, you can find those at www.coldandmissing.com. You can also review us there. You can donate to us. There's a lot of resources over there. So check us out. But that is all I have. Thank you so much for listening to Cold and Missing. I'm your host, Allie.
And I'm your co-host, Eli.
Have a great week and stay safe, y'all.
Stay safe, y'all.
We'll be right back.